Our fifth case for this morning is Gary Mister versus Metro, basically, Northeast Illinois Commuter Railroad Corporation. Mr. Foley.
Thank you. Good morning. This effectively was a case involving an FVLA slip and fall. On January 25, 2005, Gary Mister, who was a conductor for Metro, got off the train, was walking to his car, which was parked approximately 10 to 15 feet from where he got off his train. In the process of going to his vehicle, he slipped and fell on icy, snow-covered ballast. In keeping with his responsibilities as a Metro employee, he immediately notified his supervisor. His wife was present. She took him to the hospital. His supervisor, the road foreman of engines, Bob Tague, accompanied him to it or met him at the hospital, along with the railroad superintendent. A fellow by the name of Kurt Kroner, who was employed by Metro as a safety officer, received a phone call from the Metro Police Department advising them of Gary Mister's injury.
Could I just get right into the what I think the key is here? If I understand your position correctly, it's that under Rule 801D2, an admission by a party opponent, that's what it's called, is not something that requires internal verification. I mean, the magistrate judge, actually, Magistrate Judge Brown, seemed to have been concerned about why the Metro official in question might have known or not known something. But 801D2 defines as non-hearsay a statement made in a representative capacity, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
And so this Metro agent could say, you know, every third Tuesday, you know, the cow jumps over the moon, and that would have been admissible, even though that might be a rather silly thing to assert.
Well,
if that was in the course of his employment, I mean, no one's complaining here about scope of employment, right? No one's complaining about
scope of his employment, and papers that he prepared, such as Plaintiff's Exhibit Number 13, were papers that he normally prepared within the scope of his employment. If he had put on that paper that the cow jumped over the moon, it's the plaintiff's position that the document itself should come into evidence as an admission of a party opponent. Certainly, he's subject to cross-examination.
Yeah, we have the two issues. We have, number one, his testimony, which I guess you wanted.
Correct.
And then we've got this paper, Exhibit 13. So you think, number one, he should have been able to testify as to what he said in that investigatory report.
Correct.
What did you write down, you know, Mr. Kroner? Yeah, Mr. Kroner.
What did you write down? What was the basis for what you wrote down? Why did you write it down? And effectively, what was the significance of it?
So at that point, he just says, this is what I heard in the hospital, right? And so it might come out as a fairly weak report.
Subject to cross-examination, and the credibility of the witness's statement, that the party opponent's statement, certainly can be attacked by his employer, but it should have come in. It should have been published to the jury, and then we should have had an opportunity to examine the basis for the statements, why he put down on that piece of paper, in his official capacity as a safety officer, what he put down on that piece of paper. And we were denied that opportunity. And as you know, in a slip and fall case, notice is a key element of the case. And it's our position that Metra had notice of this dangerous condition, as evidenced by Plaintiff's Exhibit Number 13. If there was some question as to Mr. Kroner's knowledge of the incident, about the investigation that he performed, those are issues that should have come out in the course of his testimony. And we were denied that opportunity, and then ultimately Metro was denied the opportunity to examine him also.
Now, your opponents do argue that even if it was a mistake to keep this out, it wasn't a prejudicial error.
Correct, Your Honor. But as I stated, notice is a key element in a slip and fall case. And this was notice of a dangerous condition. Under the FVLA, Metro, like any railroad, has an obligation to provide its employees with a safe place to work.
Now, does it matter, actually, whether Mr. and the others actually were remembering accurately that somebody fell about a week before in approximately the same location, if that's what Mr. Kroner was told?
Is it important?
Right. In other words, you know, you're saying notice, and he writes down suppose everybody thinks people were falling there. Is that good enough for notice?
I believe it is, Your Honor. I mean, it certainly is notice that another individual fell in the same spot, and he's
might have fallen, at least.
Well,
I mean, that's what I'm getting at. I mean, are we really trying to get to the truth of these underlying statements, or are we really, in fact, at some other use of those underlying statements?
Well, we never got to the opportunity of exploring the actual truth of the statements. But certainly, that plaintiff's exhibit number 13, which was produced to us in the course of discovery, so Metra knew about this particular statement. Therefore, they must have known about the at least allegations that another individual, another Metra employee, had fallen in that spot. They had a duty to then examine that area and see, is it safe for their employees? Now, there's an issue as to whether or not employees should have been parking in that area. The testimony that came out was that employees routinely parked in that area, and Metra was aware that employees routinely parked in that area, and there was never any affirmative action taken on the part of Metra to prohibit employees from parking in that area until after Gary Mister fell, until the second individual fell, and that's a subsequent remedial measure that obviously was not going to come in. But the evidence that did come in is Metra was aware that employees parked in that area. They took no affirmative steps to prohibit employees from parking in that area. It's our contention that they had noticed that 5 or 6 days prior to Gary Mister's injury, someone else fell, another Metra employee fell, and yet they took no steps to correct that area, to make that area safe for its employees, which is their obligation under the law.
So basically, I mean, this really gets down to whether, in order to come in under D2, maybe subpart D, statement by the party's agent, the statement somehow has to be otherwise admissible?
The statement is a hearsay exception.
I know. I mean, it's a definition out of hearsay, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
It's not really even an exception.
It's prepared within the scope of Mr. Croner's employment.
So anything as long. So your position has to be as long as within he is the party's agent, as long as it's a matter within the scope of his employment made during the existence of the relationship, that's it. It comes in.
Correct. And it was his responsibility to perform these investigations, yeah. And then after he performed these.
Satisfy those criteria.
Correct, Your Honor.
Well, if you would like to save any rebuttal time.
I will. Thank you very much.
All right. Weiler.
Yes. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Catherine Bosky Weiler. I represent the defendant appellee Metra. Your Honors, as you were just discussing with counsel, what does qualify as an admission? The question before this Court is, what qualifies as an admission under 801 D2D?
And actually, I want to rephrase what you're saying a little bit, because 801D defines certain kinds of statements that are not hearsay. And one of the kinds of things that's not hearsay is a statement offered against a party which is made by the party's agent or servant concerning a matter within the scope of the agency or employment. And I think you got caught up on this word admission, because something isn't you can't say it's only an admission if there's an admission inside it. That's a tautological statement. And so you are saying, I think, if I'm understanding your position correctly, that only if something is independently admissible can it come in under D2 capital D. And I don't think that's right. It's defined, it certainly has to be relevant, has to meet 401, it has to meet other criteria. But I don't think there's anything other than the criteria that the rule itself sets forth for letting in a statement made by a party's agent, et cetera.
This Court has noted in the past that in order to evaluate a statement, it first needs to consider, does it qualify as an admission?
No, but I'm saying, does it qualify under D2? D2 defines certain things as admission by party opponent. That's bold-faced. And then it has definitions. And I'm saying, when you go to the definition of capital D, does this statement meet those criteria? I don't see what it doesn't meet in those criteria. You're grafting on further requirements.
The first portion of Rule 801 requires that a statement be an oral or written assertion. And then that's a statement. And subsection D states it needs to be a statement by the party's agent, which means it needs to be an assertion
sure.
by a party's agent.
He says, this is what I did. This is what I heard.
What he's saying, correct, is this is what I heard. But that.
No, but now you're saying see, that's the whole point. It's not hearsay. Maybe it's not relevant. You move under 401. Maybe it's a 403 problem. You think the prejudicial impact outweighs the relevance. There are all kinds of reasons why statements that aren't hearsay might be attacked. Maybe there's a privilege. I mean, you know, there are all sorts of things that would keep it out. But I don't see why. I don't see in capital D anything that says that the party's agent, when he's talking about something he did within the scope of his employment, why that doesn't come in.
The problem is that the plaintiff intended or was attempting to use that statement or assertion to be an assertion of truth. That
you could have said you didn't know anything. You were just listening to. See, there's cross-examination for that. You could have said you're just repeating what he said in the hospital room. Maybe that wouldn't move people very far, but it's not as though he didn't go through this procedure as the investigator.
And that's why in this circumstance, the Fifth Circuit, certainly not the circuit yet, but the Fifth Circuit has addressed this situation. When you're dealing with an individual making a statement, that's not an assertion, that's not to be taken as truth, but instead is simply a reflection of what he was told.
It is a report of what he was doing, and in that sense, when he makes up his report for Metra, he writes these things down. And you are, again, I have no, see, your rule would actually preclude almost all testimony from employees of corporations, because employees of corporations rely on things that other people have told them in the course of doing their job. If you want a gigantic exclusion from the entire realm of evidence such that corporations can't have any evidence in, then go ahead. But I really think there's a scope to what you're arguing for that is enormous.
The distinction in this case would be that the statement actually came from the plaintiff. So
it doesn't matter, though. It could have come from a nurse who wandered into the room. It could have come from if he had taken a taxi to the hospital. I don't know how he got there, but let's hypothesize. Could have come from anybody, and you want to keep it all out.
That we agree that it should have been kept out primarily because it is a plaintiff's statement and it is reflected only in that writing.
Examine the plaintiff. I mean, that's a particularly weak reason to keep it out, I think.
But it's also important to note that, as you were stating earlier, Your Honor, there may have been other appropriate reasons to not allow this evidence to come in, and the magistrate judge did point to Rule 403 for precisely that purpose. What was the purpose of this statement? Was it somehow meant to suggest notice? Well, in this case, there was the opportunity for plaintiff to offer evidence that Metra did have notice of the condition that was at issue. There was also the opportunity to present evidence that these two incidents were substantially similar. Plaintiff didn't take that opportunity. And that's
I don't know that we ever got that far, and I thought we were kind of dancing on the head of a pin about whether it was the same place, because I guess his car was only 15 feet away from the train, meaning a distance very comparable to the one between you and me.
It is, but it is a larger area of it's not a parking area, it's just an open area near the train tracks.
I understand that, but if he slipped on his way from the train to his car,
it could have been anywhere within that area, and there's no evidence of either where either happened. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
We never got to that because the district court thinks that it doesn't fit into 801A(d)(2) capital D.
But
that's the problem.
The district court did repeatedly give plaintiff the opportunity to present evidence of whether these two incidents were substantially similar, foundational evidence.
It's a business record argument for the longest time. You look at the transcripts, and she keeps saying, tell me why it's a business record. And the lawyer for Mr. keeps saying, I'm not trying to get it in under business records.
That's correct as to the 801 analysis. But Magistrate Judge Brown also provided an analysis under Rule 403 and stated, even if that were the case, even if it were admissible under that rule, it would not be admissible under 403 because it is confusing. And she gave plaintiff the opportunity to present evidence to establish why it wouldn't be confusing, why these two incidents were substantially similar, and why they should be evaluated as such. At that point, were that foundation laid, she would have allowed, she stated, she would have allowed that evidence in. That opportunity wasn't taken, and in fact, it was discussed. There is a point in the transcript when the magistrate judge is making her ruling. Plaintiff suggests he'll go ahead and call witnesses that have firsthand knowledge of the earlier incident, Mr. Wyman's incident, to lay that foundation.
Mr. Wyman's not called for some reason?
Mr. Wyman is not called. The Metra risk manager who investigated Mr. Wyman's accident is not called. None of the individuals who may have had firsthand knowledge are called to testify. Had that happened, those individuals could have laid the foundation that may have convinced the magistrate judge that she should, in fact, consider allowing Plaintiff's Exhibit 13 to be admitted into evidence, that she should allow Officer Kroner to be cross-examined as to that exhibit.
So the concern here, though, is whether she placed a barrier in front of Exhibit 13 that shouldn't have been placed, and would she have weighed the 403 considerations the same way had she had a different appreciation of 801 D2D.
But she did offer that opportunity. She did offer the plaintiff the opportunity to change her mind on that position. That opportunity was not taken.
No, I understand, but I mean, if she has the wrong idea and then she says you can change my mind, it's a difficult position for the plaintiff to be in.
But it is a position that could certainly be taken advantage of,
I guess. You know, so.
Or that's why you present subsequent evidence, which is you can present foundational evidence. There were individuals who may have had firsthand knowledge of the accident that would have had that information. Those individuals weren't presented during the trial, and none of that evidence was presented at trial. Finally, Your Honor, even if, as you are suggesting, the magistrate judge's ruling was incorrect, it's harmless error. You're dealing with a jury who had all of this evidence about notice regarding this administrative order in front of it. Counsel referred to this administrative order, all of these witnesses who suggested Metro employees were still parking in this area, all of this evidence that discussed whether or not that Metro was on notice, they should have taken action, there were subsequent remedial measures. That evidence was presented to the jury, and the jury had the opportunity to evaluate the notice issue.
Was not told that there had been another accident there.
That's correct, Your Honor. If Your Honors have no further questions, thank you.
All right, thank you. Anything further, Mr. Foley?
Thank you. Very briefly, I think whether Mr. Kroner got the information contained on Plaintiff's Exhibit Number 13 from the plaintiff himself, or our contention is he got it from Bob Tague, the road foreman of engines, that's immaterial. The fact is he got information. He prepared a written report, as he always did, when investigating an employee injury, and then he submitted that plaintiff's exhibit number 13 to the safety department, and he said he testified that at times it's shared with the law department. That should have been shared with the jury. We should have had an opportunity to delve into the basis for the statements made in that report. There's an issue that the court brought up, an issue about parking, and the cars were parked about 15 feet from the train, but parallel to the train, so they're parked along even with the train. So there's room for a number of cars. Why didn't we call Wally Wyman? I mean, it's not part of the record. Wally Wyman wasn't available to us. He suffers from Alzheimer's disease and was not available to come in and testify. We tried, but he just was not available. The fact is, we should have had the opportunity to get this piece of evidence in front of the jury. We should have had the opportunity to examine the basis for the statements in it. The jury should have been able to see that statement and then weigh the testimony of Mr. Kroner, weigh the credibility of that statement. Certainly, it's not prejudicial. There's no 403 issue. It goes to the very issues involved in a slip and fall, and specifically that's a notice. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Thank you to both counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.